The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Before we start today's podcast, I want to tell you about a new exciting program called Rewire You. It's Second City's take on professional development, using the skills of improvisation to navigate an ever-complex and challenging business world with greater authenticity and resilience. More importantly, we have partnered with the Chicago Booth School at the University of Chicago to infuse the program with cutting-edge research from the world of behavioral science. Rewire You is great for current and future leaders who want to get more from themselves and their teams. You can find out more at secondcity.com/rewireu. Classes begin soon. Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and in your life. Yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Dr. Keith Sawyer. Dr. Sawyer is the Morgan Distinguished Professor in Education Innovations at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. He is the author of many books, including Zigzag and Group Genius. Dr. Sawyer studied creativity with the renowned psychologist, and let's see if I get this name right, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, architect of the notion of flow. In former lives, Dr. Sawyer designed video games for Atari, was a corporate management consultant, and most importantly, Keith plays jazz piano, and for many years in his misspent youth, he was the musical accompanist for a host of improvisational performance groups while living in Chicago. Keith, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
So there's so much that we can talk about, but I want to start with a quote from a talk you gave in Austin, Texas at the Voice and Exit Conference. You said, quote, "Creativity is not mysterious. Creativity is not a rare insight that comes to you suddenly once in a lifetime to change the world. It's just the opposite. Creativity is a way of life. It's a process."
Absolutely. And there are so many myths about creativity. So I wanted to start out with that message. When we think that creativity is about a big, sudden flash of insight, and then we don't have them, then we think we're not creative. So it's important to get the message that no one has the big flash of insight, not even the most exceptional creators. But creativity is a process. It's a lifestyle that involves constant small ideas every day.
Right. So we talk about this a lot across a variety of industries. And I think it's a myth in American culture, right? We always want that sort of lone creative genius. And a lot of people have made a lot of money for themselves, sort of hoisting themselves up as that. But what I've sort of seen at Second City over the last 30 years is that really the people who are the most creative really have a lot of ideas, and a lot of those ideas are bad, but they produce a lot of ideas to get to the good ones.
Even the bad ideas can later generate good ideas. That's one of the first things you'll learn in a school of art or a school of design, where I've spent a lot of time. And I think it's the same with improvisation, right? Stage improvisation, that you don't know what you say is going to be a failure, quote-unquote, or not. It depends on how it's taken up and the potential that it has to move the group forward.
Yeah. It's funny, over the last 2 years, really, we've sort of dug in with a lot of academics more and more around improvisation and Second City being interested in helping sort of foster the study of that. And the first thing every academic says to me is, have you read Sawyer? Because you're like the only one. And I mean, it's such a limited amount of scholarship in this area, but really this is something that you were digging into and have been for some time.
Well, I'm glad to hear my colleagues saying that. Yes, I did research in Chicago with some top improv groups back in the early 1990s. And in retrospect, turns out that was a heady time with the people I videotaped have gone on to television and into movies. And then I used that. It took me a long time because I use a very, very time-consuming, rigorous methodology to analyze the conversations on stage from the videotapes I made. And I published a book in 2003 called Improvised Dialogues. And that book has sold worse than any of my other books. But it's a book that I spent the most time on, and I'm really proud of. I think my problem is I just made it too academic. If you are actually an improviser, there's no way you could read my book. It's
no, that's true.
Scholarly.
Here's the other thing: you were first. I mean, that's the other issue, right? More and more is when you're first to this field, you have to clear a lot of brush for everyone else who ends up coming afterwards.
Well, you know, that's a good point, and I don't think if I had not written the really scholarly book that no one read, then I don't think I could have written my business advice book for teams and managers. That's called Group Genius, because I was able to write Group Genius in a way that reached out to real people with real problems. I don't think I could have written that if I hadn't done the scholarly work first.
Right. And I want to dig into Group Genius because I've read that. There's so much that ties in it because you really dig into improvisation in that. But I also, I know you have a more recent book, which I read as well. So I do want to talk about Zigzag. And I'm intrigued by the framing you use in Zigzag. So it's an extension of the idea that we kind of started with, because you write that creativity did not descend like a bolt of lightning that lit up the world in a single brilliant flash. It came from tiny steps, bits of insight, and incremental changes, zigzags. So I want to dig into that a little bit of how you found the term zigzag, which I think is a really good one, as being the most illustrative way to talk about creativity.
Right. Yeah, it is a wonderful metaphor. So many other ways, it's a creative process. When I started with this, really, the notion of improvisation, that's what it goes all the way back to in my creativity research, and even before that into my own performing experience as a jazz pianist. And improvisation is a flowing experience where you don't know where it's going, and it does change directions, especially in a group setting where you don't know what your fellow performers are going to do. So that's my, I guess, intuition about creativity in general. So then when I started focusing on individual creativity and studied exceptional creators, I studied experimental psychology research, it turns out the creative process, even for one individual, is essentially improvisational. It has that wandering, unpredictable structure to it. So, what's a good metaphor for something that wanders, it changes direction, it's in fits and starts? I guess, we could brainstorm here in our podcast, but Zigzag is the one I chose.
Yeah, that's a good one. You also lay out 8 steps in the creative process. So you talk about ask, learn, look, play, think, fuse, choose, make. So we don't have time to talk about all of them. So I want to focus on ask, because that's always interesting in terms of improv mindset, because you're at once told not to ask questions on stage. At the same time, you're constantly asking questions of the audience. And I think your story about Howard Schultz and the evolution of Starbucks is a really good one. And I had no idea that his first coffee shop wasn't even called Starbucks. It was an Italian thing, right? It was called Giornale.
Yeah, I don't speak Italian, but I think it means something like the day or the
or the newspaper, maybe. Is that what that means?
Newspaper, something like, this.
Paper.
Yeah, and it was like you say, completely different. It's like a lot of famous or widely used creative products that they don't start out the way that we know them now. So, yeah, what happened was Howard Schultz was in Italy, and if anyone who's been in Europe knows, it's a very different experience. You go up to the bar, you get this tiny little cup with like 2 ounces of espresso in it. They're playing opera music, and no one sits down because they go in and they do a shot of their coffee.
Yeah, and then get out.
So Howard Schultz was just fascinated with this experience, and that's what he created when he came back here. He created an Italian espresso experience with opera music playing. Mm-hmm. Turns out it wasn't a huge success, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then that's where you start the process. You know what? Maybe I've been asking the wrong question. Maybe I've been trying to solve the wrong problem. I've been trying to solve, the coffee experience to make it more like this Italian experience I had. It turns out that's really not the problem people have.
Right.
And Starbucks did solve the problem people have.
And I like this idea of the essential need to ask questions as part of the process, because it assumes you're likely going to make mistakes. It assumes that you don't know everything, assumes a fairly high level of irrationality. And if there's one thing that sort of underlies, I think, most of the sort of academic areas that we've been talking about with our colleagues and ties to improvisation is at its core an understanding that things are likely to be irrational. So we need to make adjustments along the way to not allow that to take us off course and just give up.
Right, right. And I like the connection you made to the one of the principles you're taught in improv classes is don't ask questions, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because you're wasting a whole turn of dialogue. You could just say what you think the answer is going to be. When I say that a big part of creativity is asking the right questions, I'm really talking about something else. Maybe question has the wrong connotation. Hmm. But it's really about a way of listening and awareness as you're going through the process to see things that emerge unpredictably that turn out to be great, that turn out to have potential, that you follow that direction instead of sticking with the path you were on. And that ties into this improvisational notion of not writing the script ahead of time.
Right.
Right. It's a matter of being receptive to what emerges from the group. That's essentially what I'm getting at when I say you're looking for the right question. Maybe it's better to say you're looking for the right opportunity, let's say.
Yeah, and it's also the concept of play the scene you're in, not the scene you want to be in. We have a tendency somehow to – we've got this single idea, and if it doesn't turn out like that, it's not going to work. And life just doesn't work like that, and business doesn't work like that. So you really want to be in that space where you can allow yourself to go with what seems like the mistake. And the other thing, and we talked about this earlier too, is this idea of getting to abundance early. So improvisation is all about a lot of ideas so that you can find some of the best ideas. And to what you referred to as well, is some of the ideas that seem the craziest or that we think are bad end up being probably the step to the ones that are going to be the best.
You're exactly right. It's what in creativity research we call it divergent thinking, is this idea of having lots and lots of ideas and not being set on any one of them. Right? You don't get too attached. You don't get too committed. It's not about finding the one big idea and then driving it forward. It's about generating lots of possibilities and then having them all floating around you in a way and seeing what emerges from that process. It's a process where, I mean, really, it's about having ideas every day,
yeah.
Every week. At the end of the week, I advocate keeping a notebook, write down everything mm-hmm. that occurs during the week, make a habit of at the end of every week or on Monday morning, look back. That looking at what you've done is going to generate new ideas. It's always a process driving forward. And I think it's exactly the same in a group on stage in improvisation. You can take that notion of improvisationality and use it to help you be more creative in your everyday life.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm curious where you stand and what you think about the concept of deliberate practice, because I have some academic friends who have been squabbling about the importance of deliberate practice and whether it ignores other important aspects of creativity like play, incubation, daydreaming, that sort of thing.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, they're almost like two competing tendencies. You mentioned I have 8 steps in my book, Zigzag, or really maybe 8 habits of mind or 8 ways of being associated with successful creativity. The second one, right after the asking step, is what I call learn, mm-hmm. and that is based on this research on deliberate practice and all sorts of creativity research that before you can be exceptionally creative, you really do have to master a domain. You have to master a body of knowledge. It's a myth that the people most likely to have an idea are outsiders to
right.
a field. People who know less are more likely to be creative. That's just not true. You need to know a lot. So that gets into this notion of deliberate practice. Deliberate practice is how you become an expert. So absolutely, I think that's critical to creativity. But then right after that, the step 3 is one I call look, which mm-hmm. is a form of awareness where you can't stay focused in your one specialty area. You have to stay aware of lots of other things that are really different from your own body of expertise. So it's a tension in a way of the deliberate practice that gets you to being an expert, and then putting that aside on a regular basis and expanding yourself to be aware of lots of other things. And those things, you're not an expert, right? You're a dilettante.
Right. There is a my colleague Heather Caruso at the University of Chicago was telling me about a piece of research that she was reading recently that talked about people who become sort of experts in their field, many of whom kind of stay in the same position for a long period of time tended to have less happiness than people who left their field and applied their sort of mastery in a wholly new endeavor. And it felt like the next stage of that at a sort of an elevated level of, oh, indeed. I mean, because you do, once you master something, and we've seen this among people who get in creative ruts, it is sometimes hard then to, keep reinventing. And then I look at the career of someone like Bill Murray, who went from being this brilliant comic performer to having this sort of brilliant, while still funny, really applying it to an incredible dramatic acting career.
It's interesting that you mentioned career paths. There used to be a feature in Business Week magazine, and it was the very last page. It would be a vertical line going from top to bottom of the page about one person's career. Mm-hmm. And it would be someone who's very successful and, senior executive vice president of some company we've all heard of. And the interviewer would talk to this individual, and there would be a timeline. The top of the page would be where they went to high school, mm-hmm. whether they were on a sports team, and then it would go to what they did in college, and then their first job after college. And it turns out that every single one of these people had a zigzagging career path.
Wow!
No one had the linear career path where they got the degree in chemistry, then they got their master's degree in chemistry, then they went to work for a chemicals company, and now they're senior vice president at a chemicals company. Nobody had that linear career path. Every single one of them, it's this wandering, zigzagging path. I almost wanted that to make my next book, right?
Wow.
The successful careers are zigzags.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. So it's not surprising that I had such a strong and positive response to your book, Group Genius, because as you mentioned, when you were, when you were beginning this book and in the research, it was the exact same year when I started my career producing at Second City. So in 1992, I took over producing Second City, and within a year or two, I had hired almost every single actor from the long-form improvisational group Jazz Freddy, which is specifically, I think, the group that you studied.
That's right. That was one of the first groups I studied. That's one of the first places I even heard about long-form improvisation. And the first group I went and videotaped, they had 10 members of the ensemble. They would do two-act plays each 30 minutes that would be fully improvised. And then later, I found out about the Improv Olympic Theater,
yep,
which I think is more fairly described as the source with Del Close of mm-hmm. the long-form improvisation. And theirs would be more like 20 minutes, let's say.
Right.
All equally fascinating. But yeah, Jazz Freddy, Jazz Freddy was way up there with the pinnacle. The other group I videotaped that the members became very famous was the five-member team at Improv Olympic that was called The Family.
Sure.
And you may have hired a bunch of those.
I hired a bunch.
Too.
I hired all of them, I think, except for Miles. Adam McKay, I think, Ali Farinakian, Neil Flynn. I mean, these are, terrific, well-regarded. And let's also be honest, both you and I got incredibly spoiled. So, like, our first groups that we came in and started working with or watching right away ended up being the, titans. If there's a Mount Rushmore of improv, those groups are on there.
Right, and you're right, it's maybe right place at the right time. And I left Chicago in 1994, so for all I know, it was just as awesome in 1998.
Well, then it was Tina Fey, and Amy Poehler and those guys afterwards, so yeah, we had a good run there.
Right, but absolutely, yeah, you could say I was spoiled, but yeah, I would say I got the purest essence of what improvisation is capable of.
And you studied flow, so and with a renowned scholar, and I'm curious when you were studying these ideas around flow, and they may be obvious, but they might not be what you were picking up with in regard to the connection to improvised theater.
I started to think of the group itself having a flow experience. Mm-hmm. And even the actors and also jazz musicians would talk about getting in the flow of the performance. And it started to seem to me that we're not really talking about one person being in flow. We're talking about the whole group being in flow together. So I started calling that group flow. Hmm. What happens in a group when it's really at its peak, when everything's syncing together. And it tends to happen in these super creative improvisational groups. In my book, Group Genius, I talk about, of course, improv theater groups. I talk about jazz ensembles. But I also did some research on pickup basketball.
Sure.
A lot of team sports have this experience of group flow. I think especially basketball being more improvisational than many yep. other sports. But any effective team is going to be having these group flow experiences.
Well, and it's not, you know, you left when the Bulls were heating up, and it was such, you know, and Phil Jackson, who was the coach, was a huge fan of improvisation from more of a jazz and sort of Grateful Dead, you know, side. But still, I mean, when you read his books, he talks a lot about, you know, generating that kind of flow, but also this really interesting dynamic between the individual and the group. And this idea of once he got Michael Jordan, clearly the best player, you know, just without question, but once he got him to be an ensemble member, essentially, and know how to work with everyone around him, and vice versa, the group knowing how to give it up to Michael often because they needed to, that's when these championships just didn't stop.
I think you're right. It is. Phil Jackson was a big advocate of this. It's one reason they were winning, and it's a shift from, which I'm sure anyone doing improvisation like you, it's a shift away from the notion of the one star genius
yeah.
driving the success, because you just can't do it that way in basketball, because everyone's going to swarm Michael Jackson. He's not going to score anything. So the way you drive success is to use that against the other team mm-hmm. and distribute it. So then, you know, the star sort of becomes bait.
Right.
I mean, this is simplistic. I'm not a sports expert, but you cannot win by having one star. It has to be an ensemble effort. You know, even the stars would tell you that.
Sure, and you don't, and it's not like they don't become stars. Look at Second City's history. Completely ensemble oriented. Have your partner make your partner look good. Have your partner's back. And we do nothing but produce stars. So you know, and one sort of intriguing aspect of this, you write, is that many studies have found that team autonomy is the top predictor of team performance. So that's an interesting tension, right? Because you do want this level of personal and group autonomy, which is absolutely necessary. But everyone is so, although there's autonomy, they're so reliant on each other that it's completely necessary that they have each other's interests and best interests at the heart before they go out and perform.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think it's the autonomy of the group from, let's say, some senior manager of an organization
yep. mm-hmm.
Coming in and trying to micromanage what happens in the group. Or you know, some groups where your team leader is a control freak and wants to drive everything in the team. So then the team members don't have autonomy. You know, that doesn't happen in improv theater because you will train it out of
yeah.
people. You can't be driving the scene and have it be a successful performance. So it's that sense of autonomy, but I think even more important is the team itself be able to operate without these external constraints. That when you have too much top-down control, it blocks the bottom-up emergence that is really the potential of improvisation to generate innovation from the bottom up.
Yeah, and I don't think a lot of people know how this works at Second City, but Bernie Solins, who founded it and sold it to Andrew Alexander, and I had the honor to work for both men. They as executive producers of the theater and the, you know, and then was given over to me to hire people and run the organization for you know, Andrew gave me that gig. But as a producer, you hire the group, you give them their director, and then the producer does not go in the room. Like, literally, even though we're ostensibly in charge, we have to ask permission if we want to come in during rehearsals. The director will tell us when it would be good to check in on a show. And so, you know, this is not, I think, for a lot of bosses in America in particular, this would seem weird that, like, wait, it's like you're in charge, you should be able to go in at any time. But what we've discovered at different times is you send the boss in too early when things are, you know, mucking around and they're not quite there yet. There's every possibility that just that presence alone will have a negative influence on the potential creativity that's at play.
I suppose that could happen even in an organization with a very collaborative culture.
Yeah.
Where you don't have autocratic bosses. It's just the nature of human beings, right? Mm-hmm. It could even be a peer of yours, but if they're not part of that group, it's like an insider-outsider thing, right?
Yep. Yeah, but yeah, it really is. So I want to talk about the difference between group genius and group think. And maybe we need to start that with this history of brainstorming that I don't think a lot of people know in terms of. I think they just assume brainstorming has always existed and still exists as a, you know, oh, we all brainstorm.
Right, right. Yeah, there's a huge body of research. And the body of research has popped up in several books since I wrote Group Genius in 2007. This research about brainstorming that largely shows brainstorming is not effective.
Yep.
So one of my chapters in Group Genius is about group stupidity, group things. Lots of groups are ineffective. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I cannot go in front of a group of executives in an executive development workshop and just talk about how awesome teams are, because people will just tune you out. Everybody's been in a really ineffective team. So you've got to step up and say, absolutely. And the brainstorming research, brainstorming as traditionally defined, is less effective at generating creativity than all sorts of other types of group formations, which honestly, it all comes down to groups that are improvisational. Brainstorming sessions really don't have the structure you need for ideas to keep driving a process forward.
Yeah, this is an important distinction that I don't think I really grasped completely until recent years, because we talk a lot about at Second City the importance of our culture and bringing people into our culture who understand our culture, and that's all great. But I think it was less about them understanding our culture. It was people who had the practice. They understood how we do our stuff. But in fact, when we bring in people who are expressly have a diverse set of ideas and welcome them into the group, that's when you start to really bubble up interesting stuff. And you talk a bit about that sort of importance around sort of a diversity of being that gets you away from groupthink.
Right, right. Yes. There's a tension. You mentioned the culture of the organization, and I'm almost smiling here because so many of the most innovative organizations I've been in and have studied have a unique culture, and they're very aware of it, right? Mm-hmm. They talk about it. They try to nurture it. They're worried about someone coming in and messing it up. Mm-hmm. But I have also seen organizations where this focus on their special culture blocks
Yes.
forward movement.
Mm-hmm.
And blocks, because everybody see the world in the same way, and you start to not see obvious things. Or in some cases, everyone sees the same obvious things, but they don't see how they can fix those things without damaging the culture. So it's like a two-edged sword. What I recommend is that people spend a lot of time outside of that organization so that you don't get blinders on, but you also see what's going on in other organizations. You have networks, you have links, sometimes in social network theory, right, small network links. You have a lot of tenuous or thin links with a lot of different kinds of organizations. So the biggest mistake is to have that culture and then never go outside of your organization.
Right, and we inadvertently, because it was not strategic, solved a bit of this problem by pursuing a ton of weird collaborations. So whether that's stuff that we produced with Lyric Opera, Chicago, or Hubbard Street Dance, or the Toronto Symphony, or Norwegian Cruise Lines, not to mention that in our corporate division, we work with, you know, 300 to 400 Fortune 500 companies every year, where we're really brought in to dig into their culture often and offer up interesting different perspectives. But just having that sort of, you know, those sort of daily interactions with people who come from other places mixing with our stuff really keeps things vibrant. And yeah, just that's so interesting, because the history of Second City is so many of these not planned out models that then you look at and go, well, that's a great model for a successful creative organization. It's probably the reason we've been doing so great for 60 straight years, which is really unusual. There's very few businesses that have been doing original work for nearly 60 years at the high level that a place like Second City has.
It's very impressive. I'm so impressed with the organization. And you have to make a profit.
Yes.
I mean, we have performing arts organizations all over the country that are nonprofits. We have symphonies, we have ballet. And it's not that they don't make any money, but yeah, it's phenomenal that Second City has made such an impact. I mean, it had to be in Chicago
yes.
being really the home of, well, the origin of modern improvisational theater.
Yeah.
And then it continued, right? So you have
right.
a local culture, you have, and I'm sure this is still the case in Chicago, you're surrounded by, I remember when I was there in the early 90s, you'd still look in the newspaper, mm-hmm. and every weekend there would be 20 to 50 improv groups.
Yep.
And, you know, what other city, even New York City, you won't have that.
Nope.
Being bigger than Chicago, but fewer improv groups. So it's somehow, it's just part of the local theater scene. And Second City, you've been able to build on that and bring it together and bring it to a large audience. Very impressive.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and it's not just improv, right? I mean, the house music, which developed here, the spoken word scene developed here, you know, blues traveled here and then had its, you know, and jazz in terms of having a rebirth. And you think about Playboy starting here. It's an interesting city that seems to, and oh, God, I mean, just thinking about when Second City, the precursor to Second City, the Compass Players in 1955, to think about who was at University of Chicago then, right? I mean, these are the fathers of economics and, you know, just Nobel Prize winner after Nobel Prize winner, all in a city that kind of, you know, we took our name from an insult, right? We're always playing second or third fiddle to New York and L.A.
Right. Chicago is awesome. Yeah, we can all agree on that. And I haven't mentioned yet, but you know this, that I was getting my PhD at University of Chicago when I started this study of improv theater. And the group I played piano with the most was the University of Chicago undergraduate improv theater group. And
oh,
that's
yeah.
what the Compass was.
Mm-hmm.
Off of campus. So the Compass started as the University of Chicago. And, you know, I don't think it's really like this in the Chicago improv theater scene, but University of Chicago is a very nerdy place.
Yes.
So, on stage they will be engaging in improvised scenes where it's Aristotle and Plato.
Right.
And it probably was the same way back in 1955 with the Compass.
Yeah.
You know, it's a heady art form. I think it's still that way. You know, the people who perform for you, it's like voluminous knowledge of pop culture, mm-hmm. and probably also you get Aristotle in there every now and then,
totally.
Because it's that broad base of knowledge that allows you to listen to your fellow actor and make the connection and go in a different direction.
Yeah, and I mean the real poetry of this story. You know, we're taping this podcast, and Monday we're making the announcement. So this will air after that. That we're going to be creating a full-time lab with the University of Chicago to study behavioral science through the lens of improvisation. So it's this great way of going back to, you know, the roots. But, you know, I know this, and I think you would too. Like 5 years ago, I don't think anyone would have taken a chance on this. But some, you know, I think the popularization or the age of the art form, combined with so many thinkers in various fields who started now, and I think you're at the cutting edge of this, and a lot of people are reaping the rewards of your hard work, recognizing that there is something very important and about improvisation and the practice as a way to make people more effective, have them be happier, and we're gonna try to get some data around that because we have kind of a critical mass. We've got 3,000 students who are there every week, and hundreds of thousands of audience members, and lots of performers who also are interested in digging into this stuff.
That is incredible. Yeah, I love it, that connection, and you're just down the road. I mean, improvisation, it's the essence of social life. University of Chicago is a top research university for the social sciences, and whether you're sociology or anthropology, you're studying people coming together, and what happens when people come together is improvisational, right? No one follows a script in their conversation or at dinner or when they're engaging in any sort of human activity. So I think you're exactly right on that. If you want to understand how people work together socially, study improvisation.
Yep, and we're going to do it. All right, so we always end this podcast by asking our guest if they have a yes and story. So this is, ground zero of improv. You get nowhere if you say no, and you really don't get that far if you say yes. You have to say yes and. You have to explore and heighten. I'm pretty sure you have one or two of these stories.
Right. I've been thinking about that, and probably the best one I can think of is the accordion.
I want to hear this.
You're not expecting this, but I took up accordion. I thought, well, I play piano already. The accordion has a piano keyboard. I was fascinated with the instrument. And most accordions, it turns out, they're very old. The new ones are quite expensive. Mm-hmm. So things break. Paying people to repair them is expensive. So I started teaching myself how to repair my own accordion. And then it turns out not many people know how to repair them. So I started getting calls. Word of mouth, people were saying that I would repair accordions. And my first reaction was, look, I'm busy. I'm just in it to play accordion. I've got a job. I really don't want my name to get out there. But then, I did start to say, well, yes, this is I got to practice what I preach. I'm always saying one of the best ways to be creative is to do something totally different from your day job. So I started thinking about, my day job is all in my head. I'm doing theory. I'm writing books. And here's repairing accordions. Nothing could be more physical. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're there machining new parts. You're melting wax. you're scraping away wood. So I decided to go with it. And now I'm pretty much the only accordion repair person in the state of North Carolina.
I would suspect that you're one of the few on the East Coast.
Well, there are many, many better than I am. I'm still a dilettante, but... that's a case where I said, yes, I'm going to do this. And every time I do something, it's a challenge. I have to learn everything I do. So it's a learning experience. But, I think that's something maybe a good lesson to close on is say yes to opportunities to learn new things.
Absolutely. Keith Sawyer, thank you for coming on the show.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
working.